Welcome, everyone. Let's get started. I'm Kim McPherson. I'm the Director of Engineering Compliance at Google, and I'll be your session MC today. I'm thrilled to be here with the 150 characters across Alphabet to support the advancement of women leaders and this community. Events like Watermark and our work at Google in women's groups, allies, and ERGs remind us that working together as peers and supporting each other as allies raises us all up. Whether you are here to pay it forward to move us all ahead or to get inspired to create what has not yet been, you are here for the right reasons and you're here in the right place. Our Google teams are proud to be a partner of the Watermark Conference for Women. The Conference for Women offers practical tools and advice, inspiration, and peer networking. We are committed to your empowerment, to inspire you to make your mark in and for your company, and in your careers and for your community. Thank you for participating in our session today. It's entitled, Think Like a Founder. Your questions on entrepreneurship are answered. We have an amazing hour in store for you today. Now I'm excited to introduce Ann Mary Coe. Ann Mary Coe is a founding partner at Floodgate, a seed stage VC firm in Palo Alto, California. Called the most powerful women in startups by Forbes, Ann was one of the first investors in companies such as Lyft and TaskRabbit, and has been an early stage backer of many others like Ayazdi, Xamarin, and ModCloth. She is well known in Silicon Valley as a pioneer investor in the artificial intelligence space. In addition to partnering with entrepreneurs building impactful businesses based on truly intelligent AI, she's a co-sponsor of the AI Grant, a nonprofit research lab that funds work on open source AI. Her deep interest in the space began as a child. Her father was a NASA rocket scientist, and her expertise developed as an undergraduate at Yale, where she participated in the RoboCop in Paris, France. A repeat member of the Forbes Midas list, she's also a lecturer in entrepreneurship at Stanford University and a member of All Raise, a nonprofit committed to improving diversity in funders and founders. Prior to Floodgate, she worked at Charles River Ventures and McKinsey & Company. Anne earned her BSEE from Yale and a PhD from Stanford in math modeling of computer security. So now please put your hands together and welcome Ann Mary Coe, who will also introduce our panelists.
Thank you so much. We have a fantastic panel today. I'm really excited with the diversity of views that we're going to be able to get based on the backgrounds that we have here. So whereas I'm a funder, we have someone who works in the very central element of funding, Silicon Valley Bank. So we have Claire Lee here today, who is the head of early stage at Silicon Valley Bank. If you're not familiar with Silicon Valley Bank, it is probably the preeminent bank that most technical startups go to when they are first getting funding from venture capitalists. And so they are a critical partner to Floodgate. So, and before that, I know Claire was also at Microsoft and also was the founder of something called the League of Extraordinary Women, which seems like there's a lot of people here that might fit that bill. Next, we have Iris, who is actually a partner of mine at Floodgate. Iris also worked previously to being at Floodgate at Goldman Sachs and also Samasource. Iris today works on all of our follow-on financing. That's something that we'll explain a little bit during our conversations today. And finally, we are so lucky to have Sarah LaFleur here. And Sarah has very interesting background. When we spoke, we actually had a really fun time talking about our Japanese heritage and all the TV shows we used to watch as a kid. Beyond that, Sarah has been an incredible entrepreneur, starting a company called M.M. Lafleur that was named after her mother. Before that, she was working in the Starwood Capital Group in New York. And prior to that, she was also at Bain. And so I thought we would start this off as the founder within the group. We would love to hear a little bit more about what exactly is M.M. Lafleur.
Oh, thank you very much. So I started M.M. officially, our company, 6 years old, but really I started 8 years ago, which in startup years is a very, very long time. But I started it based on my own experience. I graduated from school. My mother worked in high-end fashion, and so I think through her, she got to let me touch and see a lot of beautiful clothes. So I thought when I graduated, I would also be wearing a Chanel suit to work, and quickly realized that I would not be able to afford anything close to it. And so the idea really came from, okay, can I just make better quality clothing, stylish clothing, clothing that is really thoughtful, practical, machine washable. And so we started by designing really clothing. And we've had several pivots since then. We've become known for our bento business, where you can go to our site, fill out a brief survey, tell us about yourself, and our stylists will handpick items that we think will work best for you. So that is M.M. Lafleur.
Thank you. Let's start off with Claire. What is entrepreneurship, and what is it to be a founder?
As a banker, I feel eminently qualified to answer that. I think what...
But you see so many different types of
entrepreneurs. We do, yeah. Right? I mean, what is fascinating to me is that there's probably... there's no simple answer to it. I mean, having been all over the world, engaging with founders and entrepreneurs and startups with Silicon Valley Bank, what we're seeing is this incredible phenomenon, this wave of innovation. And really, innovation is everywhere, but opportunity is not. And so what we're really attempting to do is obviously increase the probability of success of these startups. And again, startups not for everybody. In fact, I think I'd rather be in the position where I can affect, the potential, the trajectory of multiple founders and companies rather than just one. So that's why I chose to do what I'm doing with this fantastic platform. But I will tell you, there's no cookie cutter. Like a friend of mine used to say, you can't teach entrepreneurship. So he believes that it's innate. I think some of the characteristics or traits that we see with successful entrepreneurs are adaptability, mm-hmm. which is probably number one. The ability to pivot, really be open to feedback, and then understand how to acknowledge and address feedback, and then be open to advice and know which advice to take and which to ignore, which is pretty critical. I think resilience and grit, probably number two, perhaps as important, but you've really got to develop a thick skin. And I think in that, and that's probably true to all of humankind, not just founders, but the most successful ones really have a core belief in themselves, in their product, in their teams. And they attract a lot of really interesting talent to work with them and turn their dreams into a reality. So you have to be able to develop followership, which is not always easy. And then third, I think, is resourcefulness. So we've probably all encountered, hard times and tough times. And of course, most of this is cyclical, not just on a kind of global, macroeconomic level, but in our own lives, there's peaks and troughs. And so I think what I've seen is, even when things are really tough and it looks like, you haven't got enough money in your bank account to make payroll, which is kind of where we come in, actually. you have to be able to be super resourceful and mm-hmm. really leverage your network and know where to go to get that help and not be afraid to ask for help. People will fail if they just, basically stand alone and don't reach out. So, I mean, there are some of the characteristics Great. That we're seeing. And again, it means a lot of different things to a lot of people, but really what it means is you're taking your idea. It could be original or not, but you truly believe that you're going to change the world with that, and that's really what entrepreneurship is.
Great. Iris, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, at Floodgate, we tend to back founders who are starting companies that are in the technical fields. And so what that likely means is that you're leveraging software. I think to what Claire was saying, especially that aspect of grit, what we want is to back founders who feel so strongly, kind of to what your point, that if not for them, this problem would not get solved. Mm. And so they are going to do it when they're likely not going to get paid for several years because they're just earning into their equity. But they are so passionate that they are uniquely qualified or have some kind of insight that it is almost their responsibility and obligation to society to try to see this through. Mm. And it is oftentimes a very thankless job. I feel like in the Valley, we get swept up in thinking about a lot of founders almost as demigods, right? And there's some truth to that in that when we think about our own portfolio and the sheer amount of jobs that are created and kind of value that are created for the employees, the founding team, the investors who back them, it's a really special service that those founders are contributing to the larger ecosystem. But there is a lot about it that is a very thankless job. And so one of the aspects I thought was interesting about, you know, Claire kind of facetiously said, you know, SVB comes in oftentimes when you realize, oh, shoot, I can't make payroll. Mm. I'm actually going through that right now with one of our portfolio companies working with SVB. And it's to the point of no one person can build a company by themselves, right? And oftentimes, the obvious follow-up to that is, of course, they're going to need, like, teammates and employees, but it's part of being a larger community. And so being incredibly thoughtful about who you partner up with from the very beginning, whether it's the banks that you choose, if you decide to raise venture capital, then the investors, even if you decide just to have friends and family contribute, knowing that they're going to be part of your journey for the long run and wanting to be very selective about who it is that you're partnering with. Because we often joke in venture, it is actually far easier to get divorced from your spouse than it is to get rid of your investor. And so if you want to think about what that means for the long term, you know, having someone who is not aligned with you, it's going to be very hard to get rid of them. And you want to know, because we often say at Floodgate, you're going to go through 9 near-death experiences before you ever feel like you've succeeded. Who's really going to be in that foxhole with you?
So Sarah, you must have some stories that resonate for you.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Well, I guess maybe I should ask, how many of you here are at a startup currently? Okay, a good number. How many of you are thinking of starting your own startup? Okay, a few brave souls. I will say, I mean, this is my life's work. I don't imagine that I will be starting another startup, and I want to say that because I think there are a lot of serial entrepreneurs out there, and that's how we have come to think about entrepreneurs. They're born to do it, and they're going to do one startup and then another and another. For me, this is the thing that I'm most passionate about. I love fashion. I really believe in the transformational power of costume. I am a feminist, and I so love supporting working women. So this is the thing that I love to do. And I would be happy running it until the day I die, although I'm sure my investors want some sort of outcome. that's me. But I have to give equal credit to my two co-founders who joined when my idea was so nascent. I mean, it was nothing. And most people kind of said to me, oh, Sarah's starting a dress business, you know, isn't that cute? I would talk to headhunters, investors, no room is to our present company. But, you know, a lot of people at that stage aren't really understanding what you're trying to build. And my co-founders are the first people who legitimized my idea. You know, there's this great TED Talk about the first person who comes up with a crazy idea is just the crazy person. And in order to have that crazy person turn into a sane person, you need the second person, the follower, and the importance of that follower. For me, that early team of people was so essential to building my business. And if you are just curious about startup culture, you don't actually have to be the originator of the idea. You know, I would encourage you, if you are, you know, somewhat more risk averse, or maybe you're thinking, I don't necessarily have an idea, there are so many other roles that you can play in a startup besides being the founder.
I love that. I think the point is really important that being a part of startups does not mean that you have to be the founder. and that in order for you to be the founder, it really should be your life's work. Floodgate, we often say, our life's work is your life's work, representing that relationship between funder and founder. But it feels like in when you watch the movies or when you watch TV shows like Silicon Valley, there's this, you know, if you're going to start a startup, if you have an idea, then the first thing you ought to do is go and find one of these venture capitalists. Is that true?
No. Venture capital really is not for everybody. I mean, it's, I think, you know, when I look at our client base, for instance, you know, and thousands and thousands of companies that we're lucky enough to work for that are really solving big problems. You know, the journey really is very, I think, very long, much longer than we all think, and very and usually not that glamorous. And so, I mean, venture capital is really the best kind of financing for when you're at a certain stage or you're building a certain type of business, but it's not for everybody. We also provide debt financing alongside the equity financing, and actually that's very founder-friendly because it so happens that you don't have to dilute your ownership quite so much and you can extend your runway. And so,
can you explain a little bit the difference between debt and venture financing?
Yeah, I mean, really, so we're generally not taking equity or a share of your ownership away from you if we're investing. But we're looking at putting in what we usually call growth capital. So it can be, you know, fairly early stage. So when you look at institutional financing, you know, it's pretty well structured, right? So it's called Series A, B, C, D, E, et cetera. And it's really something that, as Anne said, I think you commit to it. And your investors really are your partners. You're building out a board, et cetera. Debt financing just gives you quite a lot of flexibility, and it can be based on, for instance, not just, you know, equity, but really the revenue, you know, revenue-based financing. And we're seeing that a lot, really, with, you know, models like Leiter Capital, where they're putting in very small checks very early in partnership with Silicon Valley Bank into SaaS companies that are still pretty nascent, but have got quite a bit of traction early on. And we're just seeing incredible results having gone out and piloted that for the first time in the last year. So, again, you know, look, money is money, right? All money is green. But I think you have to be pretty mindful that if you're going to commit to raising venture capital, it's quite a tough road. And I think that everybody should really research the venture community and the partners in these firms very, very deeply if that's the route you choose to go. But it's it does come with strings attached, so you just have to be very aware of what you're doing. And I think venture is right for people who are starting businesses that they really want to grow, scale, and really build a global platform or a global brand, because very few things these days are actually domestic or regional or local. And so I think the kinds of companies we're seeing today, a lot of social entrepreneurs as well evolving, which is great, emerging. And so they certainly, you know, need financing, but venture is not always the answer. And I think, great, you know, to your point, I mean, myth busting or, you know, shattering stereotypes again, is it aspirational? Potentially. I mean, I think it's, you know, wonderful what Sarah's built, but I'm sure that you've got some interesting tales as well about, you know, partnerships with investors and all, you know, the missteps that can go with that. But that's why we like debt, clearly. Yeah. Not everyone does, but, you know, for startup entrepreneurs and founders, it certainly makes sense to look at a range of things, including crowdfunding, just to get out there and you know, go and prove your concept and get initial product market fit.
Well, let me turn to Iris. As a venture capitalist, what are the motivations of venture capitalists, just in order so that we can clarify for the entrepreneurs in the room, what is it that we're trying to do?
Yeah, and it can vary by firm, so I'm going to be admittedly speaking broad brushstrokes, but for us to get involved in a company, it really needs to have the ultimate goal of reaching what we consider to be venture scale, right? And so if you are starting a business where you're hoping that it will generate cash flow and then basically supply like a good income for your family, that's fantastic, but I would discourage you from taking venture funding. Because really, if you're taking external money where you're willing to give up a portion of your company, the bigger thought process should be that you are now going to own a smaller than 100% ownership and something that will be much bigger at the end of the day. But again, with your investors, there's going to come an expectation that if you are taking our money, that's because in the long run, you are probably going to be, let's say, over $1 billion in valuation and could maybe even go public someday. And there's a lot of great companies for which that is not going to be their end goal, right? And so that's something to be highly cognizant of, which is at the end of the day, if you take external money that is in the form of equity, there is very little way for you to just pay the investors off and say, I'd like to now take ownership back. It means that they get to have not only an equity stake, but an influence in how you're going to grow the business going forward. And so that's something that I think you have to be highly cognizant of. It's also unlikely that you will ever just take one round of venture funding, because with every sign of growth that you are showing, there is going to be an increased sense of urgency about, okay, now let's help you accelerate even more. And so what that means that you are going to take further dilution. Again, it may be a worthwhile trade-off because you are now going to own a smaller portion of even a more highly valued company. But you have to understand that with every round of funding, you're probably also going to add another investor to your board of directors, which means now there are even more voices in the room that you need to actually take into account.
Yeah, so before I go to Sarah, one of the things I talk about is VC math. So in VC math, if you have a $100 million fund, we're expected from our investors to return $300 to $400 million. So what that means is usually I own, let's say, 10% of a company at exit. So if I add up the value of all of my companies at exit, and mind you, some of these companies fail, we need to own about $3 to $4 billion worth of portfolio value. So if I add up the value of all the companies at exit, it needs to add up to about $3 to $4 billion. That's pretty significant, because if you think about it, if a company exits for $100 million and you own 50% of that company, that's a big deal for you, but it's not a big deal for the investors. And that's a huge misalignment of incentives. And so you need to make sure that you understand when you're taking a check from a venture capitalist, that's the expectation. It's almost an all or nothing. We're going for the billion-dollar, multi-billion-dollar exit, or it's nothing. Right? And so that's, you're really swallowing the red pill in many ways. Matrix.
But then I think that lends, you know, the next question to be, well, why would you ever take equity instead of debt? But the reality is there are companies for whom being able to pay back a loan on a predictable basis is very hard, right? And so what you see a lot of times with venture-backed startups is there is a time period in which you are just continuously investing. So whether it's research, the technology that you're building, maybe you're trying to get to dominant market share in a marketplace, where the expectation is you spend into the business, because at some point there is this inflection point where whether it's you have enough scale that you can start charging for higher margins, you will then start getting hopefully some profits flowing into the business. But that can sometimes be tricky when it's unpredictable at which point those profits start coming in. And so oftentimes the trade-off is debt is nice because you're not giving up dilution, but unless you know that you can actually pay back the debt on the schedule that's being required of you, it can also be quite risky.
Yeah, and we generally like to get paid back. Yeah.
That's probably your business model. Yeah. So Sarah, I'm sure you went through a lot of this having gone through angel financing and then deciding to take venture capital dollars. Can you walk us through sort of what made you decide to swallow that red pill?
Sure. I would say I wanted to swallow that red pill so badly in the very beginning, but no one would give me the red pill. So that's the story. You know, I said I've been doing this for 8 years, and initially when we were getting started, it was really like Warby Parker and Bonobos was really taking off, and I heard through the grapevine that Everlane had raised a lot of money without actually having product yet, and so I thought to myself, like, well, I should be able to raise $2 million off the bat, and you know, long story short, I couldn't. And I got a lot of doors slammed in my face. And so at some point, I gave up on institutional funding and went with what's called the friends and family route. I do also want to take this moment to demystify friends and family, because it's not as though I have a rich uncle who wrote me a $1 million check. You know, it was talking to a lot of people, and for those of you trying to figure out, okay, how do I put this round of funding together, you write an email to anyone who you think has any capacity to know somebody who might be wealthy. So you're not actually saying that that person is going to write you a check, but you're attaching your deck, you're telling them about your company, and you're saying, would you or anyone else you know be interested in learning more about MM LaFleur? So that's kind of an elegant exit for that person. If they're not interested, they could say no. Or if they're interested, they'll say yes, you know, happy to learn more. You know, newsflash, rich people get approached all the time, and they're so used to this. So, you know, this is like another day for them, and nothing for you to be intimidated by. And so I did that for about 4 years. Really, it was taking $20,000 checks left and right. I should start by saying I started with my own money, so I had $35,000 saved up. So I started with $35,000. My parents lent me $35,000, so I started really with $70,000, which took me through the first year. And then it was a lot of $20,000 checks. And then eventually we had a family office who was willing to write a bigger check, six-figure check, and so we started collecting those. But really, the first 4 years, it was just that. And then it was only when we started to see revenue traction, we made that pivot that I was talking about earlier. Our revenue started to climb.
What was the pivot?
The pivot was introducing Bento. Mm-hmm. And so up until that point, we had a dot-com business, and we sold beautiful dresses, but I would see when we did trunk shows, our dresses would sell, they would fly off the rack. But when we put them online, we could not sell them to mm-hmm. save our lives. And it was this moment where I remember we were sitting in a warehouse. I think we were about seven people then, and our warehouse is 100 square feet large. And we're like, oh my gosh, there's so much inventory. We're going to die under a mountain of inventory. Which is like the last thing your banker wants to hear. So we were like, we just need to move this inventory somehow. Let's see if we'll email our customers, see if we can send them a box of dresses and see if they'd be willing to keep anything. And so that's what we did. We emailed our customers. I think we had 1,000 of them, and said, you know, we think we'll know what you like. Would you mind if we sent you a box of dresses? You don't have to keep anything if you don't like it. And we made more money in that 1 week than we ever had in that 1 month. That was a light bulb moment for us, where we were saying, okay, interesting. Our customers, we had women saying like, oh, I've been meaning to shop from you for a while. I just couldn't figure out if I was a size 6 or a size 8. Or I couldn't figure out if the blue dress would look better on me or the green dress. Like, it's so great that you'll just pick it for me. You know, we say a lot of our customers are women who don't love shopping. They want to look good and they want to look stylish, but they don't love the process of shopping. So that was the big pivot. And when we did that pivot, our revenue tripled overnight. And Anne and I were talking about this on the phone. That is called finding your product market fit. Your product has found your market. The big lesson for me was that my product was not just the physical product, not just the dresses that we sell. It's also about how we were selling it. The how we were selling our product was just as important as the what we were selling. And when we found that, I mean, really overnight, our revenue tripled. And that's when we started getting inbound interest from VCs. Sorry, that was a very long story.
No, that's great. No,
that's great. but that's kind of the journey.
And then how did you that's the moment you start getting inbound interest from VCs, and that's when you decide, okay, I'm going to go out and raise this next round of financing.
That's right, yeah. So I was like, oh, I've been offered the red pill. But honestly, at that point, you know, I'd kind of had a chip on my shoulder about do I even want to take institutional funding? I mean, they gave me the cold shoulder for so long. But I was really... I was going to say lucky. It is luck. There was a huge element of luck to it. The investor who approached me was someone who I really grew to respect. He said to me, look, I know, it's a man, first of all. You know, he said, I know nothing about women's fashion, but I think what you're doing is really interesting, and it would be great if you could just teach me a little bit more about what you're doing, which was just so different from all the other investors who had met, who kind of said, you know, like, I'm not interested. Like, you know, this has no potential for being a big company, like working women's clothing, so niche. And I was thinking, like, okay, working women's clothing, not niche, you know. So many working women out there. It's, by the way, it's so great to see female PCs up here, I just have to say. Yeah. I mean, this is part of changing the conversation, you know, female financiers, investors, all of that. So, but anyway, he was just so different from every other investor that I had encountered, and so I was happy to swallow that red pill with him. And then same with my Series B. Actually, my two Series B investors were investors who had invested in a personal capacity. Mm-hmm. And so they had kind of seen the journey for the past 4 years and had seen that, you know, when we said we were going to do X million, we did X million. So we had built that relationship. And so those were, I think it's you know, VC sometimes gets a bad name, but it's really about the individual relationships. And mm-hmm. you can find incredible investors who are really willing to go to dark places with you during those dark moments.
So we've heard it, the journey of sort of seed investing or friends and family to Series A to Series B. There's a lot of mystery around, I think, those terms. And so, Iris, I'm hoping that you could clarify a little bit, what are these series of financing? What happens in each of them? Like, what's different about each of them?
And so there'll be, I guess, a step one, there's funds that tend to specialize in a certain series or stage of growth for the company. And this is important because hopefully then the amount of support that they provide you is applicable for the stage that you're in. So for example, at Flygate, our ideal scenario is that we invest in a company that is at seed stage, so that first round of institutional funding, and in return for taking our check, we will help you company build. That's how we think of it, which is not only help you run a bunch of experiments to try to figure out if you've got product market fit, but also help you think about things like hiring and culture and what early partnerships should you be establishing to help you scale in the future. Usually after seed, where there are signs of product market fit, or if you're, for example, a SaaS company, you feel like, oh, there's a playbook now where I can sell into big companies, and it doesn't have to just be the founder who's doing it. That's usually when you graduate to what we call Series A. And you'll see a difference in the check sizes. So let's say for seed, it can be a couple million, but, you know, single digits, whereas for A, you'll start being at the higher end of the single digits into the double digits. And here, you'll have people who are looking for evidence of, okay, I think this company can scale at some point, where now we're going to focus more on hiring out the executive team and maybe starting to think about bigger and larger distribution channels. And then what you will find if you are kind of a well-performing A, and it sounds like this is what happened to you a little bit, Sarah, is you'll see the dynamics change a little bit because there's data where people can start tracking you. And that's private data, so it's not like you're publishing it in a database, but people will start kind of whispering to each other about, hey, have you seen MM LaFleur? They're starting to get a lot more traction. And it may be things like people are tweeting about the bento boxes a lot. I feel like there's a product that people are starting to really demand and pull from the company. And you'll start having probably Series B firms reach out to you saying, hey, can I learn more about what you're building? And they're really looking at it from the perspective of, if I invest now, is there maybe 1 to 2 more rounds of funding before there's an exit opportunity, right? And again, traditionally, we thought of exits as you're going to go public on the New York Stock Exchange. The last couple of years have been a little bit funky in that the expectations for what a company achieves before they go public have gone through the roof, which is why you see companies staying private longer, but then also that starts feeding into the cycle. But what you're seeing is that companies are wanting to stay private until they know they can go public at a couple billion dollars versus, I would say, 5 to 10 years ago, it was more than respectable to go public at, let's say, 300 to 500 million. But so what you're going to see is, again, both what the different series of investors are looking for before they'll come in to give you money, as well as what their expectations are for what you'll achieve with that money, are very different at each of these stages.
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing a similar kind of phenomenon. To Sarah's point, I really think it's more facilitated serendipity than maybe luck, and maybe you're being modest, but, you know, the choices that you made and obviously the traction that you were able to prove really played out. And so we're seeing a lot that, you know, the best entrepreneurs and founders are attracting you know, people to have the conversations with them when they really don't need the money. And I agree with you. There's a lot of people I know with that same chip on their shoulder, or a chip on each shoulder, which makes them well balanced, actually. But this notion that when you think about it, you know, I think 67% of all the companies that IPO'd actually were clients of Silicon Valley Bank. So we get to see some really interesting stories and data. But again, there's no overnight success, right? I mean, these are long-term, real, like, big bets, you know? And so I think what's interesting right now, and certainly having been in this industry for a while and seen it from different kind of perspectives, the constituencies we're working with are all, like, really active. So the participation from family offices, as you said, from corporates and, you know, even sovereign wealth funds and everything. There's so much capital. There really is an abundance of capital, but it's incredibly concentrated. And so just knowing what you want to do and what you want to be and how are you going to really realize, you know, your vision is super important. And I think understanding that exit path, if you do choose to go down it, you have to almost start with that as the basis. And M&A, I mean, it was a bit of a patchy year. I think last year was a bit slower for acquisitions than maybe we hoped for. But again, if this is something you want to do, then please do it. And I want to make sure I'm encouraging females in the audience to go and jump off that cliff and take a risk. If you work for a male founder and you're part of his founding team, then maybe learn the ropes and then choose your moment and go and try your own thing. Or if you're working at a corporate and you think you can do something really game-changing, then, you know, take the risk. It'll probably take a couple of times to get it right, but it's worth trying and failing than never trying at all. And I think there's lots of different sources of capital. What we saw in our Startup Outlook report that just got published in the last week is we asked, I think, 1,400 founders, mainly with teams of 25 or less, actually. I think 809 of those in the Startup Outlook report that you can find on our website are in the US. But we also poll people in the UK and China and Canada. And across the board, you know, there's great uncertainty, right? I mean, that's probably the word du jour, right? The mot du jour, uncertainty. But people are still really optimistic. And so, again, there's never a great time to jump off that cliff. And sometimes you might find that your parachute, like, has a rip in it because you're Labrador pup has kind of come in and done it. Like, that's so I'm covered in Labrador hair. You know, and you don't find out until you want your parachute, right, that it's got a rip in it. So it's interesting. I think a lot of people are coming to us and saying, look, I want to do this. I'm not really sure where I'm going to end up, but I want to start. And just starting and kind of pivoting, you know, this. I didn't understand the word pivot until I came to the Valley 8 years ago. Never heard of it. It's not a European phenomenon, I'll tell you that. Because Irish people would just say, oh, you mean you changed your mind? Okay. So it's just being kind of adaptable, right? Goes back to what I was saying earlier, like be adaptable. So this adaptability and flexibility and this resilience, all of it is what kind of makes it up. But that's where you'll attract the right financial partners. Yeah. And that's where we like to be as well, because clearly we just want you guys to succeed and hope that you pay us back at some point.
Great.
And ultimately go public.
Yeah, so I want to wrap this up because we want to get to Q&A pretty soon. So I want to go to Iris and then end with Sarah on just the advice that you would give to the entrepreneurs that are out there. Mm-hmm. You know, at least for me, one of the things that I would like for you to know is the idea of no. When someone says no to you, what does that actually mean? from a venture capitalist standpoint, no means a lot of things. It could mean I'm really busy right now and I'm in a bad mood. It could mean mm-hmm. I accidentally took the meeting at 11 o'clock and Anne is hangry. It could mean it's a sector that I just don't love. And so I don't feel like being in that sector for the next 11 or 12 years with you. It doesn't necessarily mean your idea doesn't have merit. I don't like you. You shouldn't start this company. And I think particularly for women, I would love for you to know that, because a lot of the men that I know are hopeless optimists and all they're listening for is the one yes. And then they're like, I'm totally validated. And the female entrepreneurs I hear are like, oh my gosh, this person said no to me, and then I've heard another no and another no, and their energy is like going down and down. And you can't be that way. You have to harness that inner dude that like is just super excited about your idea, who doesn't hear no, who only is looking for that one person who is a believer. Because unlike sales, finding investors is about finding that one person who believes. Mm. That's one thing I'll leave with you.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I think another one, it's kind of twofold. One is that whether you're deciding to start a family business, something small that you put up on Etsy, or you decide you're going to take a big plunge and take venture capital money, it's a marathon, not a sprint. And oftentimes, I think it's easy to lose track of that because especially in like the tech-enabled venture capital-fueled world, everyone operates with such an incredible sense of urgency that you would almost assume, oh, they're only going to do this for a couple of years. But, you know, one of the themes that you've heard up here today is, no, it's a long-term life commitment, right? That you feel such an incredible sense of, if not for me, this wouldn't exist, and that's not fair to the world. And so with that long-term lens, I would ask that all of you think of every person that you meet, every networking opportunity, as a way to firm up your own kind of arsenal of tools for whatever business you're trying to build. I think oftentimes there's been a bunch of research showing that women like to compartmentalize business versus friendships, mm-hmm. versus men are much better about being fluid between those, right? It's like, oh, you're my friend, but I could use your help and leverage our friendship for business purposes. And I think that we need to become much more comfortable with that. Mm-hmm. And on that note, my kind of second point would be amplify each other. I don't know if you guys remember back in 2016 where there was this great cover story for the Washington Post talking about how there were more women in the Obama cabinet than ever before and that they had been using a secret tool that had been discovered, which is one woman would say something in a cabinet meeting and people wouldn't necessarily react. So then another woman would echo that sentiment while giving credit to the original speaker. And they were doing intentionally to make sure that men weren't going to take credit for what was said. Because what would unintentionally happen is then if a man said it, all of a sudden it would get a lot more notice and people would credit the most recent speaker for it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, whether you're in a cabinet, whether you're in a board meeting, or whether you're just on Twitter or on social media, when you see something that's been noteworthy, give a shout out to that woman. You don't need to know her. The men are doing it all the time, and I think it's important that we help each other out.
I love that. And I would love to say two things. The first thing is that so much of the reason I decided to start the company, aside from it being my passion, was because I felt that I wouldn't be that successful in the environments that I was in. So I was at a management consulting firm, and then I was at a private equity firm, and I actually really liked both jobs, but I never thought I would get to the top, and I thought I could do better, and so I ended up starting my own thing, and I heard this line yesterday, if the pie isn't working for you, make your own pie, and so I made my own pie, and I think I'm pretty good at what I do, and so if you feel like the current environment that you're in is not working for you, change environments. The other thing I will say is if you are thinking of starting your own company, the most practical advice I can give you is to find your side hustle. We talked a lot about financing and funding here, but it can take maybe a couple of years even before you're actually ready to have conversations with friends and family. And so what I did was I started tutoring. I was 27, and still the best way that I could make money was by teaching the SATs. So I taught the SATs for 2.5 years, and it paid for my rent, and I had a pretty good life. I mean, I wasn't going out and traveling all the time, but I could do the basic things, and best of all, it allowed me to focus all of my energy on the startup. And I think the reason why this is important is because I think what I see people doing is they have some sort of savings account, and they say, okay, I'm going to start working on my startup, and then once my savings runs out, well, I hope my company succeeds by the time my savings runs out, and it probably won't. And so just by having this side hustle, this constant stream of income, and it can be anything. My husband was walking dogs for a while. bartending, working in retail, whatever it is, so long as you have that flow of income, you could keep pursuing your dream because it's going to take a while.
Great. Fantastic. Well, thank you so much.
Expertise. It's just really fantastic to have you here. So one more round of applause for me. So we're going to audience questions. And before we go there, I have one question I wanted to ask Anne. We talked a lot about funding and financing and ideas and starting companies. And there is one thing that caught my eye when I was reading up about Anne. She had a quote about her own career saying, "The main difference was that I was willing to outwork, outdo every competitor who walked through that door." Anne, can you please say a few words about the sheer value of hard work and what it means in the space that you're in?
Yeah, and I think, you know, women in general sort of fall into this trap of like, I'm going to outdo every other person in the room. And so we tend to just naturally be this way. I think I just was sort of next level when it came to that commitment. I had a period of time where I was starting at Floodgate. I was actually finishing up my PhD and I was pregnant. And I actually defended my thesis 6 weeks after I gave birth to my child. And I was like funding a company at the same time. And so everything after that's been really easy. But what you'll notice is that, you know, I think three of us here have kids, I think, and you haven't
dog.
Yet. But we have, between the three of us on this side, you know, we have, I think, what, nine of seven kids, so two, three. You learn that it's actually very possible. But it requires a different level of commitment. And I think being a founder, like, that's your baby too, right? And so I think that the ability to know what you're capable of and really know it by pushing yourself and then being able to hold on to that, that's one of my superpowers, is that I know that there was a period in my life where I accomplished all of that. And so everything else that comes along, I could do that and 10 times more. And I know that no dude has ever gone through that.
Actually, I think the hashtag for this panel needs to be channel your inner dude. The dude being Anne. Anne is the dude.
I'm a pretty good dude. I'm very optimistic, too. So I do think that, you know, that concept of hard work and knowing what you're capable of is really important. And I learned that actually as a kid when I was doing speech and debate. I think that's where that came from. My parents thought I was terrible at it, but then ultimately I discovered that if I worked really hard at it, I'd won the debate round before it even started because I'd outworked, out-hustled everyone.
Great. Thanks, Anne. Okay, so we're going to open it up for questions, and we have some rules around how we're going to ask questions. So we'd like for you to state your name and then ask a succinct, clear, single question so we can give everyone a chance in the audience a chance to ask questions. So please start. Thank you.
I'm Andrea. My question is, I'm wondering if you can debate the need for speed and this advice around pacing for a marathon and the pressure that's applied by VCs for speed. I work in a startup, and I am managing that conflict all the time. And I'm curious if you guys can debate that for us and help us understand the
great
pros
question.
And cons.
Yeah. Or who wants to start?
I think part of the sense of urgency is because it's been shown time and time again, even with companies like Amazon, that once people see an interesting business idea, and it's almost validation, the copycats come out of the woods, right? And you can't ever just raise your hand and say, but I had the idea first, mm-hmm. right? And so that sense of urgency is really around, I have to get to dominant market share before anybody else has a chance. And it will feel unfair because so much about getting to dominant market share is not necessarily the cleverness of who had the idea first or necessarily even the execution. A lot of the times it's around who had the capital to try to deploy it in a bigger, faster way. And so I think that while it's unfortunate that what it means is that it causes maybe an undue level of stress for the operators, there's at least the rationale for why that feeling of urgency exists. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Next question.
My name is Ashley Harris. My question is, we know that women aren't getting as much VC funding for their startups, statistically, even though women-owned businesses are often very successful. I'm wondering if you can talk about some of the barriers that women face in pitching and seeking out the funding and practical advice for what we can do to help overcome maybe some of those unconscious biases or the systemic hurdles that we would have to face in order to get that funding.
Yeah, I mean, we talk a lot about this and have done for a long time. Coming into this conference, actually, I did look up just the more recent data. I refer to this as the single-digit club, right? About 2% of venture capital globally goes to female founders. And until recently, when All Raise started and really made a very, very tangible impression on this statistic, which is the percentage of female GPs, you know, VC firms that are deploying this capital, which is equally important, it's crawling slowly out of single digits. So it was 7-8%, now it's 9%. And so I think, look, we're seeing some progress. And certainly when we look at our startup outlook data, we've seen progress as well in the number of women that are in positions of authority and leadership, in different companies, especially sitting on the boards and in the C-suite. And so that that economic empowerment is really important, but it's not just about the number of GPs that are female, investing in a number of female founders. I mean, diversity is really, it's proven to drive economic results, right? And so surrounding yourselves with great teams is really, really important. And so one thing we've seen is, of course, I mean, people are bootstrapping longer. They're obviously as well, some will postpone institutional financing or just not go that route at all. But what's interesting is women tend to just kind of soft pedal it anyway. When they do raise, they don't usually raise as much. And so there's this, kind of factor. And Elevest actually published a really interesting article about, everyone tells us that we're just not as confident. And, Sally Korchek and Elevest just said, turns out that data is inaccurate because, we're just as confident. So I think what's interesting is, not seeing gender, not really seeing barriers, and really getting extremely good at telling your story and defending, making everything you do highly defensible. You just got to go in there and you got to ask for it, and feel like you absolutely, totally deserve that check. And that's important.
One thing I would just say is also check out foundersforchange.org. That's a place where founders are actually, they are making a commitment to diversity, not only within their teams, their boards, but also within their investors. Some very recognizable names have actually signed up for that. And we've seen the impact of it in the growing number of female GPs coming into all male GP VCs.
Great. Next question, please.
My name is Martha. My question is for Sarah. If you were to do it all over again, but you retain all the knowledge, everything you know, would you have still gone the VC route, or would you bootstrap? Would you raise funds earlier or after product market fit, and why?
Yes, great question. I definitely still would have raised venture capital. My business would not be what it is today without venture capital. And I'm grateful that I got to access that money, so without a doubt. The advice I would be giving myself, and it ended up playing out this way, but I just didn't know it then, is that you should raise your Series A after you find your product market fit. Because to your point, Iris made the point about speed. It's true. It's as soon as you raise your venture capital, the clock starts ticking. And it's very hard to scale a business when you haven't found your product market fit. And so hopefully after you raise your Series A, what you're doing is dedicating all of your energy and resources to just scaling this idea that works. So that would be the advice I'd give.
Thank you.
Great. Next question, please.
Student, and I also was a young entrepreneur. How did you learn about investing in Lyft, or how did you do that while you were doing school, and what was your path for that?
I actually worked in venture capital before I went back for my PhD. I thought I was going to start my own cybersecurity company and then sort of ended up in venture capital. I just sort of had curiosity. I've always been sort of a very curious person, and I like investing in spaces where people aren't, and so the reason for Lyft was just basically there are no transportation startups out there except for Zipcar. This is pre-Uber, pre-GetAround, pre-all the other companies, and so I thought it was fascinating, and I bought into the fact that transportation was a huge market, would change the world, so that's what caused me to invest in them.
Next question.
Hi, my name's Katie. For all of the women in the audience who are thinking of starting their own companies, Sarah, I know you talked about the 2 years that you worked on it part-time, had your side hustle. What was that inflection point that pushed you off the cliff, and what would you say to get other people to jump off the cliff?
My jumping off the cliff story is not nearly as glamorous. I was not in a good place in my last job. And so I felt like I had no choice but to quit. And I never thought I would work in fashion. Even though I always had this idea, I thought I would do it when I was, you know, retired. And so it was a total coincidence that I felt like I couldn't be there any longer. And I thought I had ruined my resume, and I didn't know what I was going to do next with my life. And I thought, okay, well, I've always had this idea, and I have no mortgage, I have no kids, might as well give it a try. So I like to say that MM was born out of this point in my life where I was lowest in my professional confidence. And again, like, I think there's this like myth out there about this entrepreneur. We're all, you know, trying to figure out, like, we say we're like, there's this entrepreneur culture, and you say you're an entrepreneur, but what does that really mean? And it really means very little. I share that story because I'm sure there are a lot of you who are thinking, okay, my life situation's not great right now, and one day I want to do this. But that day actually might be today. You know, if your job's not working out for you, try something new.
Thank you.
Next question, please.
Hi there. My name is Yash. And my question is, if you're, you know, really at that initial stage where you have an idea, you're really young, you might not really have that level of experience yet, do you guys think that there's kind of this, like, break-even point between kind of being patient, gathering your, you know, the knowledge, like, areas that you don't have enough information about, and then finally kind of taking a more serious look at, okay, what's the next step in terms of, like, funding or, like, pitching ideas? Like, where is that, I guess, inflection point?
Well, I mean, there's no such thing as too young or too old or too anything, really. I mean, again, when you look at some of the data on the most successful companies, those founders are, you know, sometimes a lot of the time in their 40s, right, which is where I happen to land at the moment. But I don't identify with that. You know, I identify more with, you know, the university students that we bring out here every year on the trek, you know, and people like those. So I feel like, you know, we've just been through this with the last trek, actually, a few weeks ago. And so these university students said, when do you know, Claire, that it's the right time for me to drop out of college? Or should I finish my PhD before doing this? And I said, always finish your PhD. Because if you don't, your mom will kill me. But it's true. It's this balance. I mean, it there's some trade-offs for sure. But I think, you know, you'll just know when it's right. There's never a good time to have kids. You know, my two startups are now 9 and 5, almost 6. And I'm proud of that. But, you know, that you're going to have to figure out, I think, use your intuition, gather the data, make a decision.
I think being an entrepreneur is really about the idea, right? So you don't say one day, I'm going to put entrepreneur on my resume, on my LinkedIn profile, and so therefore now I'm an entrepreneur. It's more like you have this idea, and you can't stand the fact that someone else might do it. Yeah. You're living daily in paranoia that someone else is going to realize this idea that you have. And you yourself will die a thousand deaths if someone else doesn't, right? That's when you are an entrepreneur and you don't care about the other expertise you don't have, because you're going to hire people along the way who have it. Mm. And eventually, you know, you have to do everything at first. But if you're successful, you have the luxury of being literally the VP of nothing. And so that's what you're going for, right? Don't worry about the experience that you have, but worry about whether or not the idea is good enough for you.
And that's the one word of caution, I think, for speaking to a predominantly female audience, which is women tend to feel the need to have everything buttoned up before they'll take that risk, right? And so one approach that we have, Anne and I talk about this even within our own partnership, right, where she and I don't want to say something or publish something unless we feel like we could debate it publicly and win, versus other people are willing to just speak out loud and take a stand, right, and let it play out in the public, yeah. Mm-hmm. And one approach that we've instituted at Floodgate when we're interested in a new space is, let me find the 100 smartest people, because it'll be faster for me to learn by seeing their reaction versus me holed up in a room searching the internet, mm-hmm. right? And so that would be one thing I would encourage you to think about is, how can I shortcut this and make sure I'm leveraging all the knowledge that exists out there versus trying to understand things for myself?
So thank you for that answer. And unfortunately, we are now out of time, but we'd like to thank you all for coming to our panel.
Thank you.
Our session. And one more hand for our amazing panelists here.